I listened to the audiobook and I'm like, kind of like, all right, this is super fascinating. Haven't really thought about this. I got to think about it. And then I was like, what happened? Where'd this come from?
Part of Christian maturity is learning how to be around people and ideas that aren't what you have in your own head without losing it.
Welcome to Kingdoms Unveiled. Your hosts today are Doug Van Dorn, who's the pastor of the Reformed Baptist Church of Northern Colorado, and I'm John Moffitt. I'm the pastor of Grace Reformed Church in Spring Hill, Tennessee. And we're going to jump right into it today. If this is your first time listening to the podcast, Doug and I have been doing a series trying to help people think about the Divine World Council. The Divine Council worldview from a Reformed perspective, thinking about the supernatural nature of the Bible. So go back to the first episode and kind of walk along with us. But today, this is probably a little bit more near and dear to your heart, Doug. You've been on this path trying to help people connect their faith from our confession and covenant theology and Calvinism, along with the supernatural nature of the divine council and thinking about it from that perspective. And I know a lot of people are curious about guys like Michael Heiser, who's had a massive impact in your life and in mine. So today it's going to be a conversation about a reform perspective of Michael Heiser and his book, The Unseen Realm. So it's good to be back. This is our second episode today, and we have been fighting all kinds of fun things and laughing and trying to get audios to upload. So, Doug, you read Michael's work before it was published. So tell us a little bit of a story of your kind of the history of this theology, and then we can start kind of pulling apart some of the questions that people have about it as when you get done.
Yeah, so the reason why we want to do this, I think, is because both of us have run into many people in our circles who, when you hand them Heiser's book, or even if you don't, they've already heard stuff now because it becomes so popular in the broader evangelical world, that, you know, they have preformed opinions of who he is. And especially as it regards Calvinism, it can be a real turnoff to a lot of people. And so they won't even bother reading his stuff. And sometimes they'll even kind of pretend like they have read it, and then they go on Twitter and make all sorts of comments that show that they have never actually read anything that he's said, which is really bothersome to me. I mean, Mike became a friend, so I'd like to just tell a little bit of the story of how I got into this and how I became friends with him as we do this. You know, I don't know, 15 years ago, I guess, I was preaching on Exodus. And came across a paper from him that I didn't even know who the guy was. If I had listened to Coast AM, I would have known who he was, because he apparently was on with Art Bell, like, as a regular guest.
I didn't know that.
He was on all the time. I found this out after coming across another paper that he wrote and kind of connecting the dots that it was the same guy. And then I found out he had a website. I found out that he was an evangelical scholar who had his PhD in some ancient Semitic languages. And then I found out that he was on Coast to Coast, which I love, and that he would go to Roswell every year and do like these biblical theological discussions to ufologists, you know, who many of them weren't even Christians. And I just thought, that is one of the coolest things I've ever heard for missions. You know, outreach that, you know, I'm like, this is what I would love to do. So, because, I mean, I've always been like X-Files, In Search Of. I mean, if it's weird, I've always liked it, which is kind of why I guess I've found myself in these circles. But
probably,
and I really enjoy it. I think it's great. And the fact that he had the same kind of likes that I do, I just was drawn to his stuff. So in those days, he was giving away, free copy to the people that were on his web page and were, you know, subscribed to his newsletter and all that kind of stuff. And he called the book The Myth That Is True, after what C.S. Lewis talked about to Arthur Greaves, where in a letter to him, he basically says, look, Tolkien taught me that myth is very important and that it has truth in it, but the whole point of Christianity is that it tells the story mythologically, but it just so happens that it's true and historical, true. And there's eyewitnesses to it, right? And I actually think that's one of the reasons why Lewis is probably the greatest apologist of the 20th century. It's because he understood things that most apologists won't ever bother talking about. And as we've become more postmodern and post-Christian in this culture, his apologetics actually still resonates in ways that a lot of more modern apologetics don't, for just precisely this reason. He's talking about all these weird things, but he's giving a biblical spin, an orthodox most of the time spin to it, right? So anyway, I start reading this book, and I find in it that he's talking about the angel of the Lord in ways I've never heard. He's talking about the Nephilim in ways I've never heard. He's talking about this divine counsel things in ways I've never heard. And it was just mind-blowing, as it has been to so many people that have actually read his material. Mm-hmm. But he had this chapter in there that was like on, and maybe it was like the fourth or fifth chapter, and it was on, like, it was completely out of the blue. And it made no sense to the rest of his argument. And it just seemed like it was this hobby horse that he had against Calvinists. And I was like, well, I'm going to keep reading because it's so interesting, and I hope he doesn't keep on with it. And he didn't. Like, it was a one and done sort of a thing. And then I remember it was fantastic.
I remember exactly where I was in Florida. I was listening to the audiobook, and I know exactly where I was. And I'm like, kind of like, all right, this is super fascinating. Haven't really thought about this. I got to think about it. And then I was like, what happened? Where'd this come from? I almost turned it off. I was like, well, this is dumb.
And this is the reason why we wanted to do this episode.
That's exactly
that
right.
That is the way that both of us felt. And we didn't turn it off, but a lot of people have. They just chuck it across the room. So when that book became The Unseen Realm, he kept that chapter in. And, you know, by that point in time, I had actually got to become friends with him. And so that's kind of a fun story because I had interacted with him a little bit on kind of chat boards on his website, but nothing that he would ever know me from Adam. And I never, you know, I knew that he was very popular already just because of his groupies and stuff that he had. But I had this weird idea for a book, which was to create this catechism of the unseen realm and be able to give it as in a reformed way. And so it had like 140 questions, and I decided on a spur that I would send it to him and see if maybe I could get a blurb from him so that I could self-publish it. Well, he writes me back and says, can I publish this thing with my book? And I'm like, what? Then half an hour he writes me back later, and he goes, well, I can't publish this. Because I had a bunch of stuff, and it was like Calvinist, and he didn't want to deal with that, and the eschatology. But what I didn't take it in a bad way, right. I just took it in a way that, okay, well, I'm dealing with stuff that I know is not in his book. So I wrote him back, and I said, man, if you want to, you know, chop it down, get rid of questions, whatever, it doesn't matter to me. If you can use it, I would love for you to be able to do that.
Yeah.
Because I want people to, you know, be able to use this as a resource that would help them. So he said, great. So we kind of became friends at that point in time. And then Logos, their Faith Life, you know, umbrella company, started having him tour right at the time of the launch date of the book to go to different churches around the country and give seminars. So and we didn't have to pay for it. So I'm like, can you come to Boulder? So he said, yeah, I'll come to Boulder. So we got to meet, and then we walked down Pearl Street Mall and stuff like that. And he goes, hey, man, I got an idea for a podcast. Would you like to be on it? I said, well, what is it? And he goes, well, we'll take peer-reviewed literature on weird topics, and then we'll talk about them. And I'm like, yeah, I'll be on that show. So, you know, I actually did a podcast with about 30 episodes, maybe not quite 30, but there was a panel of us, about six people, that we called Peer-A-Normal. So I actually got to know Mike really well, and became friends with him.
Yeah.
And so, you know, getting to see a person in reality and getting to know who they are and you know their foibles and know their, you know, the good things about them. It's different than when you just hear a guy's name and then you hear something about him and then you're like, well, I don't want to have anything to do with him because he's not reformed or something like that.
Yeah,
and I think that when people take that kind of an attitude towards really anybody, they're really missing out on a lot of things. I mean, I probably shouldn't say this publicly, but when I do research for my sermons every week, I really don't care what the person I'm reading. I don't care if he's an ultra liberal. I don't care if he's a fundamentalist. I don't care if he's reformed. If somebody's doing work on a text that I'm looking at and it's something I'm interested in, I'm going to read them. And then I'm a big enough boy to be able to figure out if the guy's saying things that is, you know, crazy, not Christian, really good. And so if I feel like there's something that in what I want to do, I can use them, I'll use them. And I wish that more people could learn to appreciate that people that don't exactly agree with me on everything, they still have a lot to contribute to things. And in this case, Dr. Heiser had so many things to contribute to this worldview that, I mean, you know, I think we all understand that. But what we want to do kind of in this show is help people think about how should you, first of all, deal with those, you know, when you, they're not in your circles and they're not trained in the things that you're trained in. And they might even say things that go against what you believe, or they might even in some cases, like with him, say things about what you believe that you don't actually believe. yeah. I heard him do this on one of his Blurry Creatures episodes. At the very end of it, he starts talking about Reformed confessions and catechisms, talking about a certain aspect of free will or something. And he goes, and it's right there in the confessions. And I'm like, no, it isn't. What are you talking about? Like, no, we don't believe it. What are you talking about? So, I mean, what do you do when you, exactly, when you have that kind of a thing? And then especially when you have, in a case like his chapter that has caused so many Reformed people to read it, especially because it's at the beginning of the book and it's not at the end, right? So you haven't really invested yourself. They come to it and they're like, this is ridiculous. I don't want to have anything more to do with it. How should we as Christians respond to that? How should we as Reformed Christians respond to it? And so the particular chapter that we're talking about has to do with something that I, for the life of me, I think Mike thought that he kind of just got it from the Bible. So last time we were talking about biblicism, and before the show we were kind of mentioning how to me Mike had a kind of a strange thing where when it comes to divine counsel stuff, when it comes to Nephilim, when it comes to that whole supernatural worldview, he was not a biblicist in the slightest. I mean, he would go to any text, pseudepigrapha, he'd go to ancient Near Eastern literature.
And he cross-referenced the Bible brilliantly.
I mean, he's a PhD, and that's what he learned, was trained to do. But for whatever reason, when it came to this chapter and exegeting this passage in Samuel about how apparently God, you know, told Samuel one thing, but it didn't come to pass, and he's trying to make explanations of what's going on, and he just only sticks with the text. He doesn't go to any systematics. He doesn't go to any other biblical theology, really. He just like is camping in that text. And he like thinks that this is kind of his, you know, in the way that he did his podcast, the naked Bible way to come to it, as if, as if anybody can come to any text as this neutral, pristine, objective person who doesn't have presuppositions, right? Like, that's just not a possibility. I get the point of the naked Bible, which is that you really want to read the Bible in its unfiltered historical context. But we are all prone to, especially when we have a hobby horse, which clearly he did on this particular issue, to make it say something and think that we're, you know, being creative or whatever and getting out of it and really having good answers. But the reality is he was actually just giving a view of free will and predestination that has been around for a very long time. He never even bothered to
realize the church history had already dealt with this.
Exactly. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what that view is and how it's different from, you know, a typical Reform view on predestination, free will.
Yeah, for sure. And I'll even, I mean, to Mike's own defense, as you were saying, you know, he realized he had presupposed upon Psalm 82 an interpretation, and then realized when someone brought it to him, he's like, wait a minute, I'm bringing something into the text. And so thankfully, Mike set aside his seminary training and presuppositions and allowed the text to kind of force him to deal with it. But there are certain things, and I had a mentor tell me, and this is why I've tried to be very open with my theology and allow the text to force me to rethink things, but we all have blind spots. I think R.C. Sproul used to say this all the time too, but we all have blind spots where we don't understand, where we can't see the text as it was originally designed to be read. We just want to pray that those aren't the heretical sides of our blind spots. But yeah, I think that Heiser was wrestling with, he totally believed in the sovereignty of God and would teach that. Mm-hmm. But he ended up holding what's called a Molinistic view of Scripture, which it's very old in nature. And the idea of it is he's trying to wrestle with the free will of man. I'm not going to get into the technical side of it. If you want to look up Molinism, you can. But we'll kind of give you in its practical nature. He was wrestling with the free will of man and the implications of the decisions that are made and the ultimate decree of God and the will of God and the sovereignty of God, that what God determined was going to be fulfilled. And there's a Reformed, and I think biblical answer to that. We're going to get to that here in a minute. But what ends up happening is you hear things like this, where God looks at, because of his capacity and his power, God looks at every possible outcome that there could ever be, right? All the decisions of men. I mean, if you, I'm not going to sidetrack. So any possibility that could be, and God looks at all of them and ends up choosing the one that bests, that with the best outcome, that has the best opportunity. And there's that's kind of a crass way of describing it, but God is allowing the freedom of man and their choices, and he's not going to, he is not going to turn us into robots. And so not only are we free in our decisions, but we're also free in our salvation. And so the way in which I've heard it described to me and read about it is that God chose the world, the possibility of the world. So he looked forward in time after looking at all the possibilities that every human being could ever make, and he ended up choosing the one that could save the most people. So it really takes it off of him as if, you know, he's saving some and not others. He's looking at the possibility of a world where the most people get saved. Is that a fair definition?
I think that's pretty good.
and I understand, like, he'll use, you know, he would use examples of passages where you can see, like Moses is a great example, where Moses changes the mind of God, where he's on the mountain and God wanted to kill the people and he stopped him. And so there's this interaction with humanity where the free will of humanity, actually does end up dictating what the outcome will be.
Well, I think there's a little more going on there. It's sure. The idea that the future hasn't actually been predestined or ordained. It's right. that our choices and our will is actually creating the future, but because God knows all the possibilities that are out there, he's orchestrating it in such a way that, not that he's decreeing or determining the future, but that he's kind of bringing it all in a way that works the best according to all the possible worlds that are out there.
Right. Yeah. Right. That's a better way of saying it. Right. And I understand the pressure relief that causes, right? It's almost like you set up these children to, like, hey, you're free to go do whatever you want, but you kind of guide and direct them to make sure that they make, they're going to make their own decisions, but we're going to guide and direct them to come out with the best decision. And the problem is that there's too many passages of scripture that just kind of blow that out and it doesn't work out. And yet at the same time, we still have freedom of humanity. So we'll get into that here in a minute.
Yeah. So when a Reformed person hears what Mike did in this chapter, I think it's chapter 5 in The Unseen Realm, they get pretty upset because they can see that it's a denial of the sovereignty of God in the way that Reformed people have thought about it. And it's really trying to uphold the free will of man in a way that we're not comfortable even defining in those terms. Mm-hmm. And so then the question, there's several questions that kind of come out of this, like why did he put this in this book? And that's something that, in one way, I've never really come to an answer to that, because it really doesn't advance his thesis really at all. It's just sort of like, it's just a chapter that's there that kind of seems like he wanted to get it out of his system to go after Reform people or something. Mm-hmm. But there is something about what he was trying to do there, which I hear people all the time saying in the Unseen Realm world, of Middle Earth that it is, which is that God wants, and the way they usually put it is that God needs for humans to be free, to have free will, and even if I just heard somebody today say this, even if it is dangerous or unexpected to God of what will happen. Now, Mike didn't want to take that kind of a view. He wasn't an open theologian where God doesn't know the future, so nothing surprises right. him. But that's the way a lot of people think about this topic. And so they believe that the only way that you can really take seriously the fact that God is using human beings, really, truly using us, as part of the way that he's orchestrating the universe and guiding the kingdom of God and bringing about his will on earth, that he really is using us. They think the only way that you can do that is through a non-Calvinistic explanation mm-hmm. of the will. And so when we read someone like Mike talking about this, especially so early on in the book, and especially when you read it and you're like, this doesn't have anything to do with what you just talked about, it makes people at the very least very uncomfortable. And even more, you know, people will say, well, why in the world should I read anything that he's even talking about here? So what I want to say is that I really don't, at the end of the day, know why he felt like he had to have this chapter in the book. But I also know that like I said earlier, I'm a big enough boy to be able to go, I disagree with that. And I like really disagree with that. And that's okay. I can keep reading and see if what he's saying about the rest of the stuff is actually going to make sense or not.
I mean, to your point, it is not foundational to the argument of his book.
Not in the slightest.
No. And if it was, then it would be like, all right, well, I'm not sure how valuable this book's going to be because the premise is off. It's really just kind of like a hobby horse that kind of popped in out of nowhere. And I do remember I was like, this is so random. I remember when I first yeah. on the phone with you, I asked you about that chapter. I was like, that is the most random chapter. Why is it in there?
I think most of us say this about it. And so it's like, so your choice is, well, you can just hang up the book, sell it, burn it, and hope it doesn't squeal when yeah. you do it. Or you can keep reading it and you can try to actually come to grips with the things that he's saying in there. And there are so many of them that aren't in conflict with anything that we believe is reformed people at all.
Yeah.
That will help expand your worldview. So, you know, I think it's just important for people to know that it is possible as a reformed Christian to read a chapter like that and not come away going, I have to believe that, or he's going to brainwash me, or it's dangerous for me to read this. You know, you need to be fairly comfortable with where you're at personally in terms of how you're thinking about the freedom of the will and the sovereignty of God. And we'll get into that here in a second, just kind of an yeah. overview of how we would explain these things. But mm-hmm. know that there is a kernel there that he's trying to get at, which is that God really is using human beings. And is there a way that we can make sense of that without having to get just so angry that we can't control ourselves and then never have a good thing to say about him for the rest of our life?
Yeah, I think that from when I listened to Mike, it sounded like he may have had some pretty bad opposition from the reform world and through his experience.
I've had the same feeling.
Yeah, and I think it kind of jaded him. And to be frank, you and I both have had bad experiences sure. in the firm world as well, and sure. it jades us at times. We're like,
"What
oh,
do you
man.
Do? You throw? Do you just say, okay, so there's some bad eggs in the reform community, or there's some good eggs that have really bad arguments or have treated you poorly, and so therefore I don't want to have anything to do with it." My view has always been, I want to know what truth is. I don't care
that's right.
who it is that's telling me the truth. If it's truth, it's God's truth, and if there's something in it that's not true, I want to be able to be discerning of what that is. And I want, you know, I pray that God would lead me and direct me in a way that would make the most sense to me of how he's revealed himself in the scripture. But I want to know what truth is. I mean,
yeah.
it doesn't matter to me if somebody has committed a logical fallacy or they've done some immoral act in the way that they've treated me. I mean, it does matter. It hurts and stuff like that. But
yeah.
but at the end of the day, what's more important for me to just have my ego bruised or to be, you know, wanting to seek revenge or something, or to
yeah.
want to get at the truth?
I'll give you an example. You and I have a great affection for the Christian institutions by Institution of the Christian by Calvin.
Yeah.
And in his third installment of that, his third printing of that, man, his view on baptism, like he decided to go out behind the woodshed and just throw a fit. And you just read that. And even my Presbyterian brothers at times find themselves a little uncomfortable reading it because it's like, whoa, man, some of these arguments are a little wild. And, you know, Dewey's like, well, because that guy lost it and he's wrote this weird stuff and we are Baptists, we're going to throw that out. And I think you're going to be amiss. There's some golden gems in there that are really helpful and beneficial and has helped the church for many, many years. And I would say the same thing about Luther. I mean, listen, there's more, I think, that is concerning with Luther than there is Heiser at times, man. Let's just be frank. Because there are times you're like, whoa, what did he just say? So I love what you're saying in that we have to learn. I know it's the whole adage, you know, eat the meat and spit out the bones. But I think it's more learning. You know, you probably get this question a lot, Doug. Can you recommend a commentary for me that has like, you know, a Reformed view or a law gospel view.
Yeah, that's what people want to do. They want you to give them something that's going to give them what they already agree with. Well, you already have yourself, so why don't you just sit down and read the Bible yourself, and there you go. There's your commentary. It's what you say. Like, right. I don't even agree with myself all the time, John. So if how am I supposed to deal with somebody if I have to throw them across the room because I found something that I really disagree with? Man, I'm going to have to be throwing myself across the room and giving myself concussions all the time because I changed my mind on things and I'm not consistent in everything that I believe. And
that's right.
You know?
No, that's good. So hopefully this is an argument for those of you that, you know, maybe saw the title of the episode and you weren't quite sure. What we're trying to help you do is not only just read Heiser, but also just think through that
other
people. We need to learn how to read broadly.
Yeah, Christian maturity, I believe. Part of Christian maturity is learning how to be around people and ideas that aren't what you have in your own head without losing it, you know? Mm-hmm. To be able to mature about how you handle those things, to be able to think through them, you know, and even take them seriously, take them the best possible way that you can. Sometimes that's really hard. You know, in this case, I don't know that I've ever been able to do that really very well, because at least not with what he did, because I've already dealt with this subject so much in the past that I'm like, I just can't even be fair with it because it's ridiculous to me. I should try and be a little bit more generous with it, but you know, I feel like it's just wrong. I feel like I have good reasons why I think it's wrong. You said the same thing. Like, you were into Molinism for a long time. You really thought through this, and it's like,
yeah,
you know, so. We want people to be able to become more mature in the way that they're handling things ethically, you know, inside their own hearts as they're dealing with people that they disagree with. Like, those are things that a lot of times Christians don't, and Reformed people, we can be pretty bad at it too. Like, it matters to God how we respond to people that we don't agree with.
To be frank, both, and I've heard your testimony on this, Doug, we both at one point even tried to become Presbyterian. Sorry, even paedobaptist in our understanding of baptism. And it is reading resources, hearing through all the arguments. And then what do we always say? We're confessionalists, man. We're always going to go back to the Bible as our ultimate authority. But we need to read through. I love reading through a person who's really thought through, male or female, who's really thought through an argument, looked at all the resources, and has provided like a concise, really good explanation. Even if I don't agree with it, I learn more about my position because I can see all of the holes that it needs to be filled up. And so this is all that we're trying to argue for, is that, okay, we're not telling you have to agree with Mike on everything that he's saying, but Mike is definitely shooting holes in our theology, and we need to, and a lot of them, I agree with it until we get to this position. So
there's a little bit more than this. I mean, he had some issues with original sin and stuff like that make people uncomfortable too. And so it's not just like there's one thing, but.
No. And I think Mike in many ways was processing his theology, and because he was unwilling to use confessions and creeds as much as you and I would, I think that he kind of ran off the rails a couple of times where he didn't need to. But that doesn't mean the body of his work isn't helpful.
Right.
And that he was as a man that loved God.
Yeah, exactly.
I'd hate to know what I used to believe when I was first coming out of college, man.
I know what I believed about Calvinism, and I've very much changed my mind about that. When I went from kind of a basic default Arminian into the Calvinist worldview, man, I became super hyper Calvinist, and I thought it was right. And I didn't have anybody to train me in it.
Yep.
And you know, it was really through AOL chat rooms back in the day and meeting some people there that kind of set me a little bit different. It was very hard for me to rethink something that I already thought through, you know.
That's right.
So maybe we could spend a couple minutes just talking about giving a positive reform way of thinking about a couple of the issues that he brings up here. So maybe I'll give you some ideas, and I'll throw them off you and tell me what you think.
Yep.
The way that I deal with first of all, a text where God says something and it doesn't seem like it's going to come true, but it sounds like God thought it was going to come true, is that that's not the only way. It's like the only logical option is not that you have to believe that God actually thought it was going to come true, but didn't. Like, he could be using a rhetorical question. He could be saying something for David's sake or Samuel's sake or Adam's sake. Where are you, Adam? That doesn't mean God didn't know where he was. Like, it's a rhetorical question. I know right where you are, and I know exactly what you've done. In other words, there's other ways of looking at it logically that don't necessitate that I have to somehow damage God's understanding of the future. Okay.
Or change his nature.
So that's one thing. A second thing is that as a Reformed Christian, and in the way that I think the confessions read, I believe that God did endow human beings with a will. It's a real will. We can talk about that will in more than one sense. So, for example, Luther in his book talked about the bondage of the will. And what he was talking about really was that because sin has so influenced all of our lives, our wills, when we make a choice, are in bondage to the sin nature that we have. But we still have a real will, and it really does work in the world of men. And it's not a robotic thing that God is pushing a button and forcing me to do something. That's not the way God operates. But you can also talk about it as Jonathan Edwards did, the freedom of the will. And when he talked about it that way, what he was basically saying is, look, human beings do exactly what they want to do at the end of the day. All their choices that they make, whatever their choices, even if some guy holds a gun up to your head and says, I'll kill you if you don't do this, or I'll shoot your family if you don't do this. We always make a choice based on what we think is the best option at that time. Mm-hmm. And so in that sense, the will is free to do exactly what the mind wants it to do. And so you can talk about it in different ways. Reformed Christianity, Orthodox Reformed Christianity, has never denied that God gave human beings wills. We can talk about them in one sense as free will, but we can also talk about it in another sense as a bondage to the will. And then furthermore, it's important for us to say, I tell this people all the time in our church, the opposite of the will is not predestination.
That's right.
The opposite. So when you talk about free will, if you just want to use it in kind of the classic way people talk about it, God gave man free will to do what, you know, the way that they define that, the opposite of that is what Luther was getting at. The opposite of free will is the bondage of the will. And the opposite of predestination isn't free will, it's post-destination. And that's not even a thing. Like, there is no such thing as post-destination. So if you keep your categories straight and you don't swerve into the wrong lane on either one of them, you actually don't have a logical problem with anything that's going on in the text. And as a Reformed people, you know, we've dealt with passages like the one in 1 Samuel 26 plenty of times in the systematics, and I think that they make good sense of it. And so we can come away and go, all right, so there is a way that I can think about this as a Reformed confessional Christian. I don't have to agree with Mike on that. I can be confident in the way that I view this, and then I can continue keep on reading and see what he has to say about the other stuff. So what are your thoughts about those things?
No, I agree with you. You know, both I've listened to a lot of podcasts that are similar to Blurry Creatures, you know, confessionalists, things like that. People I appreciate, you know, what they're offering to the field. And at times there are ideas that are presented. And it, as you said, I think maybe before the recording, that there's really no way to view this worldview and the implications of it if you hold to a reformed perspective of it. And I think we're here to argue and say, I don't think that's necessarily true. Because when you read the Bible, it is abundantly clear. God is sovereign. He knows all things, and he is in control of all things. But it is also abundantly clear that there are implications to the decisions that we make. there are consequences to the decisions that we make. You know, you can read the story of David, where David made the decision and there were consequences for it. But in the end, I mean, I love this story about Joseph. You know, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. So there's this way in which God is in control, and yet our decisions still matter. Now, when it comes down to salvation, I think there is a confusion, and the best way I've always heard it described is that there's a difference between free will and free agency.
Yeah.
The bondage, yeah. Yeah. So our will, I mean, Ephesians 2, there's so many metaphors that are used, right? Dead, deaf, dumb, blind, imprisoned.
Smells bad.
Yeah. He had to bring you to life, right?
Yes. Right.
He had to bring you to life. And so when we're talking about the soul and its capacity to have faith, that is, you're not free in that place. People who are dead aren't free. But
well, there's zombies in Ephesians 1, but they're the walking dead, literally. It's what it says. You were
following the course of the air. That's right.
In the trespasses in which you used to walk. They're the walking dead.
But they're not dead in the essence that we think of dead, because they're still making decisions, exactly. Right? Because it says lived in the passions of their flesh. So they're making decisions to carry out the desires of their body.
Yeah.
So we still have the freedom to choose as we want. That's free agency. But we aren't alive spiritually in order to have faith. And so that's where we think it works, because it's consistent with all of the Bible in that, you know, when Jesus is describing to Nicodemus, Nicodemus is like, I'm not sure what you mean I have to be born again. He's like, how am I to re-enter the mother's womb? He's thinking on a spiritual level. And he says, look, this is supernatural. You should know this, being that you're a teacher. You know the Old Testament. You should know what I'm saying, but you don't. He said, just as the wind is blowing and you don't know where it's going, so is the Spirit, and the Spirit moves, right? So there is a what I call a duality to humanity, and I think that duality is you have humans who have the capacity to choose what they're going to do, and at times choose good things, right? Wicked people can choose to do good things and vice versa, but what they cannot do is choose to make themselves alive. And so that's the reform perspective of it. And I think it still plays out fine. And, you know, I don't know. Did you ever have opportunities to talk to Mike about his view on this?
No, I stayed away from it.
He was a pretty smart guy.
There was one question. I don't remember what the question was in the catechism that was very predestinarian. And he wanted to change it. In fact, he edited it out. And I said, no, you're not going to do that. You're going to keep it what it was. And he goes, okay.
Yeah,
so let me bring one more thing into this, which is the idea of the will of God, not just our will.
Yes, thank you. Thank you.
John Piper, now here's another guy that he was actually my pastor in Minneapolis for 4 years.
I forgot about that. Yeah.
So, you know, I have a fondness for him too. But he's got some things that I very strongly disagree with, probably more strongly than some ways than I do with Mike on this. Like, there's some things about him that I'm just like, not good, not good. But I'll tell you what, he wrote a paper back in the 90s that you can get online called Are There Two Wills in God? It's the best thing I've ever read on this subject. And what he's doing is he's dealing with the biblical data that the word will is used in more than one sense. So it can be used of the prescriptive command of God. God does not will for you to murder someone. In that sense, human beings can violate God's will because we murder all the time. However, Bible also uses the word will in a decretive sense, where what God decrees, we cannot violate that at all. Like, it's not possible. And some of these decrees that are specifically mentioned involve millions and billions of free will decisions of human beings in order for them to come to pass. Which
I mean, the most basic one is you will die.
Yeah, that's why our confession comes to the point and says, you know, God decrees all things.
That's right.
And so these things are held in tension in the Bible, but they're not contradictory. They're understandable. The Bible's using the word in more than one sense. And so we do have ways of thinking about, you know, all of this that I think are, to me, they're much more satisfying because I think that they take the totality of God's word instead of just one chapter or one little thing here and there, and try to make a theology out of it. And this is why I believe as a Christian, I don't understand this fight for the life of me. The biblical theology versus systematic theology. Like these guys are always fighting with each other. We need systematic theology and we need biblical theology and we need historical theology and we need exegetical theology. They're all helpful to us.
Dude, and you know what you just described? The four tires of a car, man. It takes four in order for it to work right.
Well, unless it's a three-wheel car. Or a unicycle.
Fine, three. But what you're saying is, it's true. Like, biblical theology balances out systematic theology. You need them both. And if they're done properly, then you're going to come to a proper understanding. But if you only do systematic theology, you're going to miss out on a lot. And if you only do biblical theology, you're also going to miss out. So I think there's a healthy balance where we have to be careful not to fall onto one side or the other. I grew up not really being, was not given a biblical theology. And I was given a very poor systematic theology.
I think that's
the way
most of us were, yeah. Poor systematic, no biblical.
Mm-hmm. So I'll throw this out there, you know, for those of you that want to keep following Doug and I as we're trying to explain this, but those of you that kind of live in the blurry verse, the blurry world, that they're kind of entering to this supernatural perspective, there's like multifaceted perspectives that are out there, and I'm always fascinated to listen to them. But what we're trying to argue is that what we want to take all of what Scripture has to say throughout all of history and allow it to inform our view. And this would also include that Doug and I, you know, when we think about where the world is going and we think about all the supernatural things that are happening, there is a sense where we are preaching the gospel because we believe it is the power of God to save people, and that the mission of the church never really changes, and that no matter what happens in our world, the mission of the church and the Christian is always going to be the same, which is to proclaim Christ and Him crucified. It's going to be that which transforms people. Now, that being said, he and I will both admit, we don't know what strange things are coming down the pike, man. I got no clue. I'm not even going to be the first to try and tell you that I'm not quite sure how the world ends other than Jesus comes back and wins. But between now and then, you know, I think there's the one thing I know for sure is that the church wins, the gospel advances, and people are saved by the preaching of the gospel. And at times we allow, I think, I've just seen some books and I've seen some authors out there where the mission of the world is to like to preserve certain aspects of our world. And I think our theology, what we're trying to present here, which is a biblical understanding of salvation and of end times theology, helps kind of encapsulate and keeps everything at its center and its core. And, you know, we may have said this offline, but, you know, I do get concerned where people get so infatuated with the supernatural and these creatures and beings that's becomes what they pursue.
Yeah.
You know, trying to track this stuff down. And I don't think that's healthy. I think it could be a part of a theology and bring in the color of our view of God in the world and help inform us, but it can't be the thing that we pursue because we're supposed to be seeking first.
Yeah,
that's
one of the things that Mike did so well in this book and really all of his stuff is he never had these things as an end to themselves. He always had as the end telling the story really of, you know, in his case, the bringing back of humanity to the divine council and how that works itself out as us as Christians becoming sons of God and judging angels and the gospel going out. And so that's one of the reasons why I think it's what he's done has been so powerful in some ways, other than this, you know, a chapter here or there. he really wasn't on a hobby horse of personal vengeance and vendettas against various parts of Christendom.
No.
He was really wanting to give the gospel to people, and he's doing it in a really powerful, unique way that hasn't been talked about in this way in a long time in the church.
Yeah. And I'll close with this. Doug, this is how theology has been done all throughout history, right? We take what's been written in the past and we build on it, and we can see it in a clearer light because we can take their work and then make some corrections to it. This is what our confessions are. Is that not fair?
Yeah,
our
exactly.
Confessions are, they're built upon clarity.
They're We've built upon at, the creeds, believe it or not.
Yeah, absolutely.
The foundation of our confession of faith is the Nicene Apostolic Creed and the definition of Chalcedon. And then what they're doing is they're fleshing it out into just broader areas of life.
Right. So I think we can take a lot of what Mike has done here and not give up our creedal and confessional perspectives in church history, but at the same time, look at what he has to say and say, I think we have a fuller picture of what Scripture is saying. And I think he did help regain a lot of what was lost for many, many years for various reasons. And I'm thankful for it. And
yeah,
so I'm thankful
too.
For, yeah. Well, that is the Reformed perspective of Michael Heiser in the Unseen Realm. I think it was gracious and kind and what it should always be. I don't think the guy was a heretic. Let's just say it that way. And I think he has a lot of worthy things to read. And I've been thoroughly blessed by all of his work. I've read all of his works. And I think that I would encourage people to read them as you would read anything. Use discernment and wisdom. So, all right, brother. Well, that was a longer one, but I think it was good. I think it's going to be helpful. Hopefully, those of you who are Reformed will take to heart some of the stuff that Doug and I have to say and maybe be a little bit more gracious in how we're handling this going forward. Not telling you to embrace everything, but just maybe
not at all.
Be a little bit more gracious.
Yep.
Yeah. We admit there are problems. So, all right, we will hopefully see you around the throne of our King. But if not, we'll have another episode for you, Lord willing, next week. We'll see you then.